In spring this year, after that group of students had been kicked out of the Maitre Birth Midwifery Institute, Emily and Yolanda seemed to have a moment of taking stock.
From the women who left the program, who did give us quite a bit of negative feedback, a theme among all of them was, this is not a midwifery school and you shouldn't sell it as that.
So in response, they rebranded the Maitre Birth Midwifery Institute, or MMI. Emily explained why on a call with the remaining students.
I'll be honest with you guys. I think I just overplayed my hand. I think Yo and I overplayed our hand calling this a midwifery school.
Now, it would be the Maitre Birth Mentor Institute.
Which is the same thing. It's literally the same thing. Like, none of our material changes. It's the same program, same everything.
Emily appeared concerned about the use of the term midwifery, which is regulated in many jurisdictions.
You know, it's hard for me to admit this because I don't want it to be this way. But when it comes down to it, in some legal frames, the word isn't ours to use.
FBS also added a disclaimer to their Instagram, claiming its content was for educational and informational purposes and not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition related to pregnancy or birth. It said, "For medical advice, consult your healthcare provider." Emily and Yolanda were also dealing with another unfolding crisis, the Reddit community. You've mentioned it before, the one called Free Birth Society Scam. It accused FBS of using cult-like tactics, and it also included stories of baby loss and mothers nearly dying after listening to FBS content. In August, Emily and Yolanda decided to respond by recording a podcast episode together. They were both pregnant at the time they recorded it.
What is a really shocking development in the beginning of this year to catch wind of a hate group that has formed about you and I.
Emily and Yolanda pushed back hard. Here's Yolanda.
They made up a bunch of stories and told a bunch of lies, and a bunch of other women who I think were also to some degree lonely and isolated believed them. And ultimately, it was and is nothing, really just jealousy, the normal stuff, the stuff that anyone with any degree of impact or fame deals with, projection, essentially.
The episode was an hour and a half long. It was called The Fruits of Cancel Culture and Mob Mentality.
I know, with unwavering truth, that what I'm bringing to the world is incredibly important and of so much value, and that the work I do is in devotion to mothers, babies, and humanity, whether they appreciate it or not. It's not of my concern.
They called the Reddit backlash a public smear campaign, witch hunt, and bandwagon of slander and vilification. They also rejected the idea that FBS is like a cult.
The contention is that, you know, how is it possible for this story that you're both villains and liars and grifters and thieves and baby killers and manipulators and cult leaders, how can it not be true if so many women are saying it, right?
From The Guardian Investigates, I'm Lucy Osborne. This is The Birth Keepers. Episode 6, Death Plan.
What do you think about the FBS message about radical responsibility? You're shaking your head.
I don't know if it's appropriate for me to say it's bullshit.
Adair's daughter, Ilex,
was stillborn in January 2021, following 115 hours of labour. Adair was working as a musician and songwriter in North Carolina at the time. She did not have health insurance and couldn't afford a private midwife. She had not considered an unassisted birth before finding FBS.
Okay, I'm going to press play now.
Okay.
We played extracts of Emily and Yolanda's podcast, the one we just mentioned, to Adair. Here's Yolanda.
I would describe the short version as sort of being that a bunch of very deeply insecure, bitter, sad, lonely women who had put us on a pedestal and really projected onto us what I see now was a real desperate desire for a guru. Like, they were looking for cult leaders. And they did a kind of 180 when they realized that we're both human to begin with. We're normal human women. And that we're also actually truly committed to self-responsibility, which I think for many people, if not most people, is an unbearable proposition. It's very difficult for people to really understand even what that means, let alone how to implement it. And these lonely, bitter women banded together and created, as you said, a little hate club so that they could feel a sense of validation.
Adair hadn't listened to it before, and we watched her react. There was this quiet fury on her face.
I want to be clear that, like, I don't think it's their responsibility what choices I made with the information they put out there. Like, that part is on me. But I wonder where their personal radical responsibility comes in recognizing the impact of their work and understanding that women like me are not making our personal choices in a vacuum. And I feel pretty angry hearing them essentially say that they don't hold any responsibility to any of us in any of this. Like, what was the point of the work you were doing if not to influence people and make a change in the world?
There was another section we wanted to play.
Ready for the next one?
The part of the podcast, this bit from Emily, that honestly shocked me.
Women who are thriving aren't spending their time in hate groups. And so it's already just such a bottom of the barrel consciousness. Oh, I mean, I feel really, really sad.
It's really sad.
Sad thing. And it, learn from it, see what's here for us and move the fuck on, because that shit is like, it's like I'm picturing in Bali when you get a pedicure, you can choose to put your feet in a little fish tank where the fish just chew off your dead skin. It's disgusting, but I've done it. And that's what it makes me think of, just these little, like, gross, like, gnats.
Sorry, I just had to take a second with that one. You're a gnat eating my dead skin at a high-end resort that I can afford to go to because I've taken money from you. You poor low consciousness dweeb. I'm going to say two things. One, against all odds, given the last 5 years of my life, I'm actually thriving in a way that I'm really proud of. I'm happy with my work and my family and my friends, and it's a good life that I have found. And I want to point out that directly because of my involvement with Free Birth Society, I will never again thrive at the level that I once could have, because my child is dead. And my child is dead because of information that I received from Emily and Yolanda. I made life-changing decisions based on that information that I paid for.
Like Adair, every lost mum we've spoken to has spent months, years, trying to unpick what happened to them. What responsibility does FBS have for what happened? What responsibility do the mothers have? Emily and Yolanda offer a service for mothers seeking to understand why their births went wrong. It's called a birth trauma debrief. We've seen no evidence that suggests that either Emily or Yolanda have any training in grief or trauma therapy.
Hi.
In May last year, Camille Voiteau logged on for a Zoom call with Yolanda from her home in Frontignan in the south of France.
I imagine meeting you so many times. I just never imagined this case. I'm so unbelievably sorry.
Camille had lost her son Marlo in a free birth just weeks earlier. At the time, Camille couldn't afford Emily's $350 per hour price for a debrief. But Yolanda agreed to give Camille a discount of her rate. So Camille paid her $150.
I just remember seeing her on my computer screen and talking to her live and thinking I was talking to a celebrity, like, oh, I'm so grateful, I'm so lucky, I get to talk to Yolanda.
Camille had decided to free birth after researching it for over a year, seeking out French and English resources. She'd purchased the complete guide to free birth, listened to the podcast every day, and read Yolanda's book, Portal.
Maybe you want to tell me, like, your first reaction from reading it, because I took the time to write it yesterday, so it's fresh.
Camille had emailed Yolanda an overview of what had happened during Marlo's birth ahead of the call.
My first reaction when I read it and the response that I had after reading it several times is how much your beautiful baby's birth resembled births that I've witnessed and my own births as well. And just how unfathomable the mystery is of life and death.
Early in her labour with Marlo, there was a moment when Camille saw meconium in her waters, where she felt there was something wrong. But she opened her laptop, rewatched some of the meconium chapter of the Complete Guide to Free Birth, pushed away that intuition and decided to stay home. On the call, Yolanda told Camille that it sounded like a normal birth.
There's really nothing about your story that indicates anything that really is out of the realm of what can be completely normal in a birth that results in a baby that is fine and healthy, you know? Yeah, that's what I thought, and that's why I needed to talk to you, because it's like, of course you're trying to make sense of everything, and it's like, when your brain goes back on, it's like, what's going on? But
we can never know if things would have turned out differently if there had been a medical professional there. But when I listened to her recording of the debrief, there was something Yolanda said that I wasn't able to get out of my head.
There's an overall assumption that the outcome was wrong, that death is the wrong outcome. And I don't think that can really ever be true.
We've talked about the FBS philosophy on birth, but we haven't talked about their philosophy on death. Here's Emily telling her students about it.
So a baby dies, and a story could be she shouldn't have died, right? Now, whose business are we in when we say the thought she shouldn't have died?
Emily taught them to always have what she calls a death plan. They needed one because, as Emily has suggested to her followers, stillbirths are not rare.
It's not rare. It's not rare in the free birth world. It's not rare in the normal mainstream, you know, hospital setup. It's natural death is occurring at all stages of life. And I don't know if I'd say common. I don't know what would define it as common, but it's definitely not rare or uncommon.
Her first advice, if the baby is stillborn, don't rush to call 911. Let the family grieve in peace.
There is no rush to do anything if the baby is gone. Something that will sometimes happen, or I'll hear about these stories, is the baby's born dead. And somebody, the doula or the dad or whoever, will knee-jerk call 911 in case there's just something that can be done. Well, obviously that doesn't actually make logical sense. Dead is dead.
In a conversation with students about avoiding the involvement of child protection services, Emily warned them to be wary in cases in which babies die after being born alive. Then, she told her students that if she gave birth to a baby that later died, she would mislead the police into thinking the baby was stillborn.
Yeah, I would certainly lie. If my baby was born alive and then died, and then I involved the police, that baby was born dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the benefit? Yeah. I gotta be careful on this recorded line, though.
Emily also suggested it was up to parents to decide whether to seek medical help in an emergency.
For some women, giving birth to a severely compromised baby at home and allowing that baby to die with dignity in the arms of their family who love them is a reasonable outcome.
We spoke to experts about this. They said that children have rights to medical care, so if a child dies that was born alive and you didn't try to help them or call 911 after you saw they needed help, that's potentially breaking the law. That goes for parents as well as anyone else present, including birth keepers. If grieving families chose to bury their baby on their land, Emily passed on this advice.
I remember asking an underground midwife in Australia what they do with babies who die. And she said, we just dig a little deeper.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that. I've never forgotten her saying that.
There's this apparent fatalism in FBS that can be hard for outsiders to understand. If you've given birth to a baby, you'll be familiar with that terrifying moment between the baby being born and the baby crying. That silence when you don't know if they're okay. It can be so scary. But Emily and Yolanda, they're willing to wait that silence out and not worry. Because they teach that babies need to choose to claim their breath. Choose to live. Here's Emily speaking on the FBS podcast.
So babies don't need to be suctioned. They need to learn how to breathe on their own. They need to, you know, I could get into a whole thing about the spiritual context of this, but I just think it's so, I think it is so profound to marinate on this idea of your baby walking with this story at his back or her back that she knew how to get born. And she claimed her breath.
Even if that process can take far longer than most people would find acceptable.
Some babies can take, you know, 5 minutes, even longer. You know, I've heard of babies transitioning, yeah, for even 10, 15 minutes.
Here's Yolanda talking about free birthing one of her children.
He was born limp and seemingly lifeless. And it didn't even cross my mind to give him breath or to do anything to him. Just because that's not how I approach things. That's not my instinct.
Emily took the same approach when she had her second baby in a free birth in October 2022. She filmed the aftermath of the birth and posted it on the FBS Instagram. Her newborn son appeared pale and limp.
Hello. Hello, my sweet baby.
Emily glanced at her husband, Johnny, behind the camera, who was filming her.
I knew you were a little boy.
The baby grunted and showed signs of acute respiratory distress.
Take your time.
Over an agonizing 4-minute, 40-second video.
I'm not worried about you.
It was hard to watch.
That was just absolutely nuts. Yeah, it's okay.
In the video, Emily did not call 911 or resuscitate him.
Okay. Yeah.
The video got 8,200 likes on Instagram and was influential in the FBS community. Yeah. We showed it to experts. They observed the baby was floppy, pale, and not breathing. One said that it would be standard practice for a professional in these circumstances to suction the baby's mouth. Within a minute, a midwife or doctor would have begun resuscitation. Not just to keep the baby alive, but to ensure they did not suffer brain damage from oxygen deprivation. Michelle Telfer, a Yale midwifery professor, said, quote, "It's like watching a parent sit by the pool while their child is quietly drowning and they do nothing." Emily's son survived, and she later reflected on the moment on the FBS podcast.
I looked at him covered in mucus and gunk and fluid and thought about this bizarre ritual that so many providers and even mothers themselves participate in, the sucking of a newborn's face in their first few minutes of life. I felt my quick interest in wanting to do that, in wanting to help, in wanting to hear him cry, but I just breathed instead and smiled and kissed his face, knowing that he would claim his life.
For Emily and Yolanda, when a baby claims their life, they choose to live. And when a baby dies, to quote Yolanda, it's not necessarily the wrong outcome. Coming up, Camille tries again to get answers.